Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. NPR commentator Julie Zicafus has an extraordinary talent for seeing and sharing all those little dramas that play out around us in nature. Her latest book, Letters from Eden, between her beautiful prose and vivid watercolors and sketches, allows us to walk with her through an entire year of discoveries and observations that she made on her family's 80 acres in southeast Ohio. She joins us now to share some more about her experiences. Julie, welcome to Open Line once again.
Good morning, Charlene. It's wonderful to be here.
Great to have you. Your book really did make me want to find 80 acres myself and just walk around watching birds and wildlife and watching plants go through their life cycles. Was that the effect that you were hoping to have on readers?
I guess so. Yeah, I think I'm sort of a compulsive sharer, and I find that the world is just so crammed with delights, you know, that I can almost hardly stand June because there's so much going on and I can't possibly see and experience it all. So I find myself just running around you know, like this morning, looking at butterflies and showing them to my visiting relatives and identifying them all for them and telling them about the flowers they use. And, you know, I just love doing that kind of thing. So I think, you know, it kind of leaks out of me. So whether I had a notion to leave people inspired to go seek it out themselves or not, it's just something I have to do.
Well, and in fact, that's kind of interesting because even if you're not a person who is maybe comfortable in nature, the words and the pictures make it possible for you to sort of experience that vicariously.
Yeah, and you know, I think that it's kind of sad that there's so much vicarious experiencing in this world today.
Well, yeah.
You know, I keep a blog 5 days a week at juliezicafus.com, and I have a lot of people who are sort of like confined to office cubicles who are getting their vicarious hit of nature that way. And while that is my entire intent in doing the blog, what I really hope is that they then go out and experience it themselves.
You have one huge advantage over most of us, though, is that you actually have studied biology and you really know something about the animals and the plants that you're dealing with,
mm-hmm.
whereas
mm-hmm.
most of us don't. And you also grew up really being out in nature with
mm-hmm.
your family and observing things up close. How do the rest of us get that when we haven't studied it and we're not trained in it?
Well, actually, you know, it's nothing that you can't do with a few field guides. And my best allies in all this have been my little library of field guides. That there's a wonderful one out now about insects by Ken Kaufman. And it's just amazing how all of a sudden, once you unlock the mystery of what this thing is, then you have a powerful tool to find out why it does what it does and what makes it, you know, a hooded Appalachian cockroach, for instance, you know. Found a very strange bug crawling around on the bathroom floor. It was not your ordinary cockroach, and I found out that by some fluke it had come in through our house foundation. It was a brown hooded cockroach, and reading further after finding out what it was from Ken's field guide, I found out that they're social, they live together in rotted logs, they care for their young, and they're quite local and rare. And I was just jumping up and down with excitement. And this thing was as long as my thumb. You know, it was the kind of bug that gets your attention.
Oh, absolutely. And some of us would not care to study it. We'd rather run from it, frankly.
But come on, a social cockroach, you got to love that.
Now, that part of it is really interesting. But
yeah.
Honestly, Julie, that part I'm willing to totally experience vicariously.
But they feed their young.
Okay. Now you're going to have me going out trying to find these things, and maybe some of our listeners too. Part of, I would think, at least half the battle is just slowing down enough to notice things like that and to be curious about it.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, my husband, Bill, who's the editor of Birdwatchers Digest, Bill Thompson III, he and I, from the moment we got together, have had this sort of tug of war about I call him Thumper because he's always thinking about the next big thing he's going to do. And when we walk together in the woods, I sometimes have to say, be in the moment, because, you know, he's thinking, oh, there's that broken fence, I got to fix that. And, oh, here's, you know what I mean?
Yes,
so it's,
yeah.
It's kind of like you have to force yourself to breathe and look and just be. And for me, there's kind of a little inner voice that I listen to that sometimes will tell me to sit down at a particular spot. And a gray fox will walk by. You know, it's mystical. It really is. It's a matter of tuning in. And I think sometimes when you feel that you're in the presence of a creature, you are. And you need to listen to that voice and let it show itself to you.
There was a fascinating segment in the book, too, where as far as noticing, you're walking along and you notice something red in the stream bed. And then you stop to look at it. And I guess what was fascinating is that you didn't just discover what the red thing was. You were like a detective on a case.
Oh, yes.
Talk about that experience a little bit.
Well, what I saw was part of a freshly opened possum. It was actually half a possum. And it was lying in a stream bed. And from there, I, of course, wondered who killed it. And the clues were all there. I reasoned that had it been a large canid like a coyote, it would have carried the whole possum off. So I realized that it was something that wasn't strong enough to carry the entire carcass, which was probably 4 or 5 pounds. So I thought owl immediately, and sure enough, there were the droppings. Now, owls drop their droppings straight down in a white puddle, and hawks shoot them straight out. They have powerful ejector muscles in the cloaca to make them able to do that. Owls lack those muscles. So when I saw the puddles around the possum, I knew right away it was an owl, and I thought that it was probably a great horned owl, since I don't think a barred owl, unless it was very hungry, would want to tackle a full-grown possum. So from there, I figured out who did it, and then my aim became to see it. And on my next walk, I saw the great horned owl cut across the pass right where the possum was flying. And I did a painting from that sighting, because it was just such a wonderful validation of the sleuthing that I'd been able to do.
Did it make you feel really proud of yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. So there's a little pat on the back for you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because, you know, you're always trying to figure out who done it, or, you know, I remember once, you know, great horned owls will eviscerate their prey. And I remember once taking my then 6-year-old son out to show him a pile of rabbit guts, and he said, "I don't like nature very much." I felt really bad that I subjected him to that, because I find it all so fascinating. It's really hard to gross me out, because I just want to go beyond the you factor and into the why and how and you know, find something out.
And I would imagine after being around it for a while and having that curiosity about it in that direction, it just really doesn't bother you.
No, it doesn't. And you know, I've prepared a lot of museum specimens of birds and been in done their stomach contents and things like that. So I have a kind of an unusual viewpoint. And I find one of the things about, to get back to the sort of separation from nature, one of the things I find interesting about the thousands of people who comment on my blog is that most of them have a very strong ick factor. And yet they're very fascinated to learn something from someone who doesn't have that. And I think that that's the first thing that you kind of have to conquer to be a good nature sleuth is just get over it, you know. Just go ahead and stick your hand in it or pick it up or smell it or whatever it takes to find out more about it. Because you're not going to learn anything if you're recoiling.
Mm-hmm. And, well, and also I think, do you find that once people have an understanding of why certain things happen, like the owl eviscerating its prey, just ripping it open and basically spilling its guts. Once you understand why that's happening, all of a sudden it's less repulsive, and it's just, that's the way it is. That's nature.
Yeah, and well, as I explained to my son, I opened the rabbit's stomach for him, and I said, look, it's crammed full of grass and clover. Owls don't like grass and clover, so they take that bit out of their prey, and they leave that on the ground, and that's how you know it was an owl that did it.
There are also things that are extremely beautiful in this book. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is how you capture the movement and even personality in the animals that you paint, because they look so lifelike. And you'll do a painting of a bird and it looks like it's about to take off, or you'll be describing a fight between two birds and you can paint them and you can see that confrontation happening.
I know you're probably thinking of the Carolina wrens rolling over and over on the ground.
Yes.
That was a really fun painting to do, because it's obviously something that even if you're sketching quickly from life, there's no way you're going to get that gesture. And that's where the cutting up birds and the knowledge of the anatomy and skinning them really comes in handy, because once you've done that kind of thing and you've manipulated the limbs, you can draw a bird in any position. You can turn it upside down. You can extend its wings in your drawing. And so it's that basis of knowledge. You aren't wed to copying a photograph of the bird. And if you can't find a photograph of the bird in the particular pose you need, you're stuck, right? So so if you know your way around the bird's body, you can flip it upside down. And in fact, right now, I am watching a nest full of Carolina wrens. Five babies are about to fledge this morning from a hanging basket right outside the kitchen window.
Oh, and you can look right at them.
It's unbelievable. So I've been standing with my 300-millimeter telephoto at the window for the last 4 days, photographing the parents as they come in with food.
Uh-huh.
And getting a photographic record of their whole, you know, life, home life. And what I can't tell you how strange it's been to watch this, because 3 days ago was Daddy Long Legs Day. And
Meaning every
prey item that the parents brought into the babies was a Daddy Long Legs body with the legs taken off.
Huh.
And I was thinking, man, there goes that urban legend about the baby that ate one and died, you know? These baby wrens are being fed on Daddy Long Legs. And then the day after that was Camel Cricket Day. And they focused on camel crickets and brought nothing else to the young. And yesterday was stink bug day. I would not have thought that any bird would eat a green stink bug.
But they do.
That's what they brought in.
And they have a whole day where they just pick one food item and that's all they bring. Is there a reason for that?
I'd love to know. My guess would be that they get their search image going, they find a source, and they clean it out. And I think the source for the green stink bugs is our mulberry tree. The stink bugs are clustered all over the mulberries,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's just real easy for them to go and just get stink bug after stink bug. But this morning, I saw one of the babies take a stink bug and then spit it out twice.
So maybe they don't all like stink bugs after all.
Well, I sure wouldn't. So the parent took the stink bug and gave it to another baby. It was pretty funny.
Did you and your husband plant things around your property deliberately to attract certain kinds of wildlife?
Absolutely, yes. And when we came here, it was a tabula rasa. They had not done anything. There was one dahlia coming up by the air conditioning unit. So we had just what we wanted. We didn't want to have to undo somebody else's plantings. So we've created raised beds and butterfly gardens and prairie meadow. And we've planted trees that bring birds in like crazy, including red mulberries, which a lot of people don't like because when the birds eat them, they have then, of course, splat purple all over your laundry. But
we're yeah.
I'm willing to take some stain sheets. That's fine.
You are very, very tolerant of things like that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
In fact, it's one of the things that I admire you for, because you will actually help the animals, even if it means inconveniencing yourself.
Oh, yeah. I've got a Hummer with a ruby-throated hummingbird with a concussion that I'm caring for. And she was found on Sunday night about midnight in a warehouse in Marietta. And she had been in there for an unknown length of time. She was quite debilitated. And she had a concussion. And that was evidenced by the fact that her head went all the way over to the right, and she couldn't even raise it. She was just bent in a circle. And when I saw this bird, I thought, oh, man, because she'd been without food for about probably 18 hours. And I started hand-feeding her from a syringe. And now, let's see, it's Friday. What is today?
Today is Wednesday.
Today's Wednesday. So that was last Monday. It's been, what, a week and some.
Mm-hmm.
Now she is flying beautifully. She's perching. She's feeding herself. And I'm going to move her out to a flight tent here pretty soon. But you do have to be willing to drop everything and say, yes, I'm going to feed this bird every 20 minutes because I think it can make it, and it's worth it to me.
But you have a lot of leeway because you work from home, right?
Right, that's correct. And work, I would use that word very loosely at times. I became a lot happier when I told myself one fine day while I was hiking through the woods that hiking in the woods is actually my job, and noticing things is my job. And so I shouldn't feel that I'm playing hooky from sitting at the desk and writing or drawing or painting. I should feel that it's all part of the big scene.
Well, and when you're doing that, do you take your sketchbook with you or your notebook with you so
yeah,
you can sit down and write and draw as you look at things?
Yep. I don't sketch in the field as much as I used to. I went through a period in the 80s where I was doing that intensively and into the early 90s. And now I'm – writing has sort of taken over for me. And so what's happening is that I'm sort of looking at the drawing and painting as sort of enhancing the writing. And it hasn't become my main pursuit because I started off as an illustrator, and that's what I did. Magazines and books did it for years and years and years. And I have to say I enjoy writing more than drawing and painting now because it seems a so much more unbounded and limitless thing to be able to do, to just let your mind go and you know, or maybe research something and just really find out a lot about it and then convey that. That really gives me a lot of joy.
Okay. We're talking to Julie Zicafus, artist, writer, and NPR commentator, about appreciating all of the different types of life that are going on around us in nature. You can join in the conversation, ask her a question, or give a comment. Just call us at 292-8513 or email us at openline@wosu.org. Now, you spend so much time outdoors and so much time observing, Julie. It's second nature for you. How can the rest of us get started doing those kinds of things and making it a habit? Where do you go? What do you do to get started?
Well, you know, there's so much good information about Ohio's parks and reserves. If you live in an urban area, you know, just get yourself online and look up a nature reserve or a park nearby. That's, you know, find a destination that makes you happy, go there. But, you know, even in suburban areas, just putting up a bird feeder can open up a whole world to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just invite the birds into your yard, do a few things around, you know, put a bird bath with a recirculating pump in it that'll bubble and bring birds in. So, you know, you can do a combination of deciding that it's worth it to you to get out and you know, finding a place that you like that you can, you know, is fairly easy for you to get to, get a little beat or something that you can walk, and see if that doesn't spark you, you know.
Mm-hmm. What about the Audubon Society or groups like that for help? You're seeing all kinds of interesting birds and you have no clue what they are.
Well, we have a wonderful organization in Ohio now. It's rather new. It's probably only 4 years old. I may speak in error there. But the Ohio Ornithological Society is an amazing resource of like-minded people. And my husband, Bill Thompson, has been involved in you know, on the board and sort of helping shape the organization. And it's full of people who are passionate about nature, but it's also full of beginners. And I think one of the mistakes that people who don't know anything or have any basis but really want to find out, one of the mistakes they make is assuming that birdwatchers are going to be snotty to them or be unwelcoming. Nothing could be further from the truth, especially at Ohio Ornithological Society get-togethers. They have three or four get-togethers a year. In the winter, they'll go look for raptors, hawks, and owls, maybe at the wilds, you know, that reclaimed strip mine near Caldwell.
Sure.
Or they will go to a state forest, a Shawnee State Forest, which is a hotbed for southern warblers, and they'll all get together there and bird it intensively for a few days. But there's also people, you know, who are interested in botany and butterflies and dragonflies. There are some amazing amateur naturalists in Ohio who know way more than a lot of the professionals. And an organization like the Ohio Ornithological Society is a great way to get tapped into people like that who can mentor you and bring you along.
Okay. Now, do you consider yourself a conservationist? Because you seem to do a lot to make sure that the animals and wildlife around you is properly taken care of.
Oh, definitely, yes. And I worked for the Nature Conservancy's Connecticut chapter for 6 years. And one of the things that I did when I worked for them was to develop a program to protect nesting least terns and piping plovers along the shore.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on the front lines of conservation, posting the nesting areas and trying to keep people out and explaining to people why they can't drive their ORV right through the colony of birds that are nesting on the sand. So I've done a lot of that kind of work. But, yes, I think, you know, everything I do is I was thinking about it yesterday as I was doing the recycling. I thought, gosh, I've been living green for 30 years.
Yeah.
I've always recycled. I've always, you know, burned what I can and smashed what I couldn't and hauled it into town and put it in bins. And yeah, so and with our land here, we have like-minded neighbors who also have 85 acres, And we deliberately bought land to border onto theirs. And so we have 165 acres of contiguous woodland here. And, you know, we're the only people for miles around who don't timber it. And not that that's a bad thing, but we want to see what happens when the trees are allowed to get big.
Okay, so you just let your land go however nature wants it to go.
Well, up to a point. I mean, we have about 12 acres of meadow that we mow, and we try to mow it when there are no birds nesting and when we will have minimal impact, and that usually means early March. So we go out and we'll mow it just to get rid of the wood, like the sumac and some of the Japanese honeysuckle and the black raspberry, which comes up in droves. And so we'll mow that before the bird nesting season starts, and now we've got field sparrows nesting out there, and we had a meadowlark thinking real hard about nesting in our meadow this year. So so we consciously manage four birds, and we work around their schedules.
So you have your own nature preserve that
Oh, yes.
You live in the middle of.
Oh, yes.
Ah, beautiful.
It's really something else. It
and
really is.
You have, there was a frog that you write about in the book, and... I would talk about that experience a little bit. I just loved Fergus and his story.
Yeah, Fergus is a very popular frog. I think he's long dead.
Poor Fergus.
I know. Well, I think the reason I like the Fergus story so much is that it's an example of nature coming up and dope slapping you. And and so what happened was I have this little 200 gallon backyard water garden that I just adore, and it's full of goldfish and lily pads and all that good stuff. And I thought to myself, oh, this pond needs a bullfrog. That's what I'll do. I'll go get me a bullfrog. So I went to a pond that had them, and I got some tadpoles about the size of apricots. A bullfrog has a two-year tadpole, so it spends 2 years in the tadpole form before it metamorphoses into an adult. And I started feeding them. I gave them mealworms, and I had this one I could feed from my fingers, and I named him Fergus. And he got big real fast. By the end of his first summer as a frog, he was the size of my palm. And what he started doing was he was lurking under the pink water lily in the pond. And I didn't know it, but every time a hummingbird came down to feed at the water lily, he'd snap it up.
Oh.
So my clue into this was finding a set of hummingbird tail feathers floating on the pond surface one morning. And I thought, that's weird. And they were bent, so I could see they'd been pulled out. And I looked at Fergus, and he was looking very fat. So I started really paying attention, and I know that he got three or four more before I decided to put an end to his career. And the thing that really tossed me over the limit was the day I came down and found a chipping sparrow's tail sticking out of his mouth.
Yeah, Fergus got caught red-handed that time, didn't he?
Fergus got caught red-handed, yes. And I took him to a nearby pond and released him where there was – see, the problem with our pond is that it's the only water for about a mile and a half around, so we get tons of birds coming in to drink there. And I put him at one of these boring old farm ponds with nothing around the edge and a whole lot of surface area, and I thought he'd be fine there, and he couldn't get birds there.
Yeah, so Fergus could be happy and the birds could be safe.
That's right. And then the next evening I drove by slowly to look for him floating on the surface, and I saw a great blue heron standing there.
Oh,
so
beautiful.
I'm pretty sure that's what happened to Fergus.
Okay, so Fergus...
he got his.
Beautiful bird got Fergus in the end.
That's right.
The birds got their revenge.
That's right. But, you know, here's the moral of the story. You never know what nature's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you can assume that everything's going to be fine. But what I'd really done was introduced an apex predator to a very small ecosystem. And it was upsetting in the end.
Julie, we're going to have to take a short break right now, but we will talk more when we come back. This is Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown, and we'll have more after these announcements. This is WOSU 820 Columbus.
Philosopher Alain de Botton's new book is about work, the beauty and strangeness of jobs we never think about.
How many occupations never make it really into public consciousness, even though they're the occupations that keep the modern world humming?
I'm Neil Conan. Alain de Botton, The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work, Plus, what's your memorable vacation disaster? Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It starts at 2 o'clock. Also on Talk of the Nation today, it's Wednesday, so NPR's political junkie is stopping by to discuss all things politics. Talk of the Nation begins at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. And good morning. I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. 80 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:31. WOSU Public Media, in cooperation with the FCC, is providing Central Ohio residents free in-home assistance with installation of their digital television converter boxes. The Connect the Community program is available to all Central Ohioans through June 30th. If you need help obtaining converter box coupons, can't connect the box yourself, or need more information, call 1-866-723-4626. That's 1-866-723-4626. And in the weather forecast, sunshine today and a high near 90 degrees, clear skies tonight and a low of 68, and a chance of rain for Thursday. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to our conversation with Julie Zicafus, artist, writer, and NPR commentator, talking about appreciating all of the different life forms that are active around us in nature. You can join the conversation by calling 292-8513 or email us at openline@wosu.org. Julie, the book is illustrated with absolutely beautiful and very vivid watercolor illustrations of birds and turtles and Fergus the frog and all the different animals and even some of the plants that you see around you. Talk about how the artwork and the narrative came together.
Well, I can't really do a piece of art without writing something on it because I'm a documenter. I like to know when and where I found something, when and where I sketched something. And so I've always written these little captions on my paintings since I first started painting in the mid-70s. And so I think that was really kind of where my writing came from, was the need to tell more. To tell a story with the painting, but then to annotate and to tell more, because I cannot put a lid on the observations. You know, I have to convey as much as I know, and so that's kind of how it grew out. It from the sort of the classic, you know, Victorian naturalist's tendency to collect, identify, draw, paint, catalog, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know. And it all kind of goes together in the memory banks. I'm writing another book right now, which is a memoir about birds that I've known in my life, and it's really neat to just sit down and sort of sift through my memory banks and think, you know, what significant contact have I had with this species, and write down what I remember about what I've observed, and then you know, you can get some marvelous stories out of that if you've been thinking about cardinals, you know. If you sit down and really start thinking about what you know about cardinals and what you've observed, and I've raised a couple of them, so you know, I had observations from that. So I kind of crafted a chapter around these kinds of personal observations that not a lot of people can make. I think in order to really know a bird, you have to be its mama.
Ah, interesting, and yeah, certainly that's something that you've done many times over.
Yep.
And talk about the bird that inspired you and your husband to choose your house.
Oh, yes. When we were looking for our houses, we had a tough time here in Southern Ohio because we'd find a really nice piece of land, but the house would be just something you'd need to push down and start over. Or it would maybe be a double-wide trailer. Nothing wrong with them, but it wasn't what we wanted to live in. And so, you know, we had a lot of trouble finding a place that really suited us. And we found our place after about 9 months of searching and, you know, coming up blank again and again. And we were looking at it, and we walked around under the deck, and there was a Phoebe's nest, the eastern Phoebe, nesting in a little mud and moss nest on a strut of the deck.
And this is a bird that's about what size?
It's a flycatcher that's about the size of a house sparrow. It's a small flycatcher, and it's distinguished by nothing in its coloration. It's just kind of a drab gray-brown with a grayish underparts, but it wags its tail as it perches. So a lot of people notice that about it. So we just Bill and I looked at each other and said, we have to live here. We have to live here. There's a phoebe nesting under the deck. And we've done a whole lot to the house since then, but we knew we'd found the germ of what we wanted when we saw that bird.
Was that like an omen for you that
totally.
This is a sign, this is where we're supposed to be?
Oh, yes. And we wound up naming our daughter Phoebe.
Oh, because that's your favorite bird.
Yes, it's a wonderful bird. And we're overjoyed this year because we had a pair of Phoebes start nesting on a little relay box under the same deck. And for some reason, they laid 3 eggs and then abandoned the place. I have a feeling the female must have been killed by something. We have nesting sharpshinned hawks on the place as well, so I suspect that a sharpshin got her. And then we have a bunch of little shelves we've put up under the eaves all around the house, and a pair of Phoebes has taken up on them, and they have a clutch of week-old babies now in their nest right under the front eave. So it's just a wonderful year for us.
And your children must love living in this kind of an environment.
They do. And right now, my about-to-be 13-year-old daughter, Phoebe, is stationed at the kitchen sink shooting photographs of the Carolina wren nest, which if it fledges while I'm on the phone with you, Charlene, you're in trouble.
Oh, no. I was going to tell you, you know what? Just let us know and then take some pictures because we don't want you to miss that. You just have to share it with us.
Fill some airtime, Charlene. I got some photos to take.
Yeah, I'll be reading from the book while
That's
you're
right.
taking the pictures.
No, I wouldn't do that to you. I think they're going to stay put, but they're about 13 days old, and they're getting real jiggy.
Okay, so any time now.
Yeah, one baby is hopping around. It's in a hanging basket full of geraniums, and one baby is perching in the geraniums as I speak. So it's not going to be long.
Okay, and we should mention fledging is what, when they just first start to fly?
Correct. Fledging is when they finally decide to boot out of the nest, and they almost no songbirds ever return to the nest once they fledge.
Okay.
Now, Phoebes are an exception. Phoebes will come back and sleep in their nest for a few nights, a trait that I find so endearing. The babies will be out trying their wings all day, and then they'll all come and sleep together in their nest.
Oh.
But that doesn't last long. You know, pretty soon they find places they'd rather be. But, yeah, Carolina wrens, once they leave the nest, that's pretty much it. They all pop out together, and so obviously I want to be there for that moment and capture that with my camera.
Oh, sure. No problem. We do understand. And in fact, we're talking to Julie Zicafus about her book, Letters from Eden. If you'd like to ask her a question or make a comment, maybe you've had an experience with wildlife, with nature, with birds, give us a call. Share it with us at 292-8513 or email openline@wosu.org. You are a year-round naturalist. There is no season of the year that you're not out there looking and doing things. Was that what inspired you to arrange the book in terms of the seasons?
That was out of necessity. But there's really no other way to organize a collection of nature essays, I find. And I thought about it a lot. It's the natural way because as you say, I'm out there tromping around all year round. It's everything I write has a very strong seasonality to it because I'm describing everything I see around me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there were chapters that were very strongly winter tinged and chapters, you know, there's very few what we call in NPR evergreen stuff. You know, very few things that I do are evergreen. Most of my things are very much tied to the weather, the seasons, what's happening right then.
What's your favorite season and why?
Oh, it's hard to say, but I tell you what, this June is giving October a real run for its money. I love October for the colors and you know, it's just sort of slowing down of things and the sort of heartbreaking beauty that it has. But this June, I feel like I'm drunk all the time because it's just been we've had just the right amount of rain. Everything is as green as it could possibly be. It's as if the trees have twice as many leaves as they usually do. And there's an amazing butterfly hatch. And, you know, the wildflowers were crazy this spring because they had enough water and the frogs were wonderful. I always consider it a wonderful summer when our frog puddles don't go dry.
Oh.
We have spring peepers. We have mountain chorus frogs, which are a rather rare and local Appalachian specialty. We have wood frogs. We have green frogs. We have American toads. And now we have Cope's gray tree frogs breeding in those same puddles. And they're undistinguished mud puddles to anyone's eye. But, man, when you can see 6 species of herps breeding in one puddle, that's a fat year.
That's really, that's outstanding. That's like winning the lottery for you.
It is. It's crazy. It's great. And you know, the Cope's gray tree frog waits until late May and June to breed. And it really depends on a wet year. So you've got to figure that as dry as so many southern Ohio summers can be, you've got to figure that that's a long-lived animal that has to wait for just the right year to get a bunch of tadpoles out.
Julie, what about for people who live in the city and the suburbs, if you wanted to have a wildlife habitat around your house, what are some of the things that you would suggest doing to encourage wildlife to settle in?
Well, one thing, a real good first step is to reduce the amount of lawn that you're tending and plant. You know, plant shrubs and bushes that have fruits and flowers that birds and animals like. And there's lots and lots of good resources to point you in the right direction. The other thing is, of course, to go native, to stick with native vegetation, because that's adapted to the birds and animals in this area. It's adapted to the climatic conditions. You cannot beat purple coneflower for attracting butterflies, or butterfly weed. Amazing, amazing plant. Very hardy, very long-lived. And, you know, sticking with some of the native wildflowers, and, you know, having said that, I plant a lot of exotics, too. I mean, there's nothing like a zinnia for attracting butterflies, mm-hmm. and that's so easy to grow from seed. I'm also a huge proponent of container gardening, and I think for people who have nothing more than maybe a patio or a balcony, you can just get some great big planters and fill them full of flowers, and you'll bring hummingbirds in. You'd be surprised what'll come in.
And what about attracting butterflies? That's something that we've tried to do in our yard, and we aren't having much success. What kinds
really?
Of things do you need to plant to attract butterflies?
Well, like I said, zinnias are fantastic. The Chinese butterfly bush, Buddleia davidii, is also another wonderful plant. I'm looking out my windows now and looking at the most popular things. Butterflies tend to like small flowers in flat-topped heads. So things like yarrow and verbenas are very popular. Heliotrope they love. I would just really recommend going online and sort of doing a search for butterfly flowers.
Yes.
You know, making sure that you're starting with the right species to start with.
Okay, and you don't have to have a whole lot, just...
Well, it helps to mass them.
Okay.
You know, it definitely helps to have a whole bunch of one thing. And the things that are the most popular on our place, way beyond any of my exotics, is common milkweed. Common milkweed is in bloom right now, and it's covered with fritillaries and silver-spotted skippers, painted ladies, red admirals.
And these are all the different kinds of butterflies that are coming
yes,
in.
Yes, yes, yes. And the other one that's just a crazy attractant is the common dogbane. It's a milkweed relative. It looks a lot like milkweed, and it's considered by most people to be a weed, but it's just incredibly attractive and has a very long blooming season of white flowers that the butterflies are crazy for.
Oh, so we can get started planting some of that stuff in
pots
if you don't have but a little space, and in your garden if you have a larger space.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have a call now from David. Hello, David. You have a question today?
Yes. Good morning. As much a comment as a question.
Okay.
Some of the things that you've been talking about with your guest, and I have read her book, by the way.
Fantastic.
People in the urban centers can be more involved. And you know, she mentioned bird watching clubs and going to your local parks, which is an easy and close method. But another thing is, it doesn't get mentioned much, is to get involved in hunting and fishing. You know, I know there's a lot of people in urban areas that have been kind of misled that hunting is not, you know, a good activity to be involved in, or fishing. But, yeah, few people realize, I'm sure your author knows, that probably about 80% to 90% of the wildlife that they're able to view today in parks and other wild settings is directly linked to the conservationists over the last 100 years. You know, hunting, fishing licenses are paid for, the research and the land acquisition. And you will learn so much about nature just by going out and participating in something like hunting.
Well, you know, hunting, you can hunt with a camera, too. I mean, you don't,
sure.
You know, I think a lot of people recoil at the thought of ending something's life in order to enjoy it. And I find I activate some of the exact same seeking instincts that a hunter does when I'm stalking a bird with my 300-millimeter telephoto lens.
That's exactly my point. In the last few years, I have gotten in the habit now, because I do a little bit of writing and things, and I'll take a notepad with me and a camera if I can. And while I'm sitting out there in the marsh, that 50 minutes out of every hour when there's no activity, I've gotten some wonderful photographs, and then they'll take some notes on things that I would never have seen had I just been on a walk in the park for an hour.
There you go. It's about slowing down. It's about sitting and taking in the environment.
That's exactly. And, you know, and especially when you're in, you know, more of hunting, I don't want to keep going on that, but because you're actually a part of it, you're participating as a predator. So you need to conceal yourself. You need to learn how both the predator and prey species react when there's a predator around, and how to conceal yourself, and how these animals and even insects react when there's motion.
Sure.
And you simply don't learn those things when you're taking, for instance, a nature walk in a local park.
I think it's really it's about trying to melt into the environment as much as anything, and trying to reduce your impact and your presence, just trying to be unnoticeable.
Mm-hmm. And just not disturbing any of the wildlife that's around you, because the whole point is to be able to watch them and to be part of nature,
right,
rather than an invader or an intruder.
And I think a lot of people are not aware that we are being watched as closely by wildlife as we're watching them, probably much more closely, and that many of the behaviors, in fact, I'd say most of the behaviors that we observe in wildlife are a direct result of its being aware of our presence.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you might say, oh, well, geez, Carolina wrens are such nervous birds. Well, that's because you're staring at it.
They wouldn't be that way if you
right.
would give them a break, give them a little space.
Right. They behave completely differently when you're in a blind or inside the house observing them that way. So, yeah, so I think it's they're watching you right back.
Okay. David, thank you for your call. Now we have Mike on the line. Hello, Mike. You're on Open Line.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Julie.
It's hi.
A great conversation. I just sort of wanted to make a comment about sort of a distinction that I've come to within the last couple of years, I guess more strongly, as there is no difference between the man-made environment and the natural environment, and that it all exists within nature. And wherever there's a human being, there's nature. So the comment made at the beginning that somehow or another this cubicle exists out there, and that's not part of nature, or there's nothing there that exists that is influenced by nature, I've taken on as a different viewpoint, that wherever I am, there's nature.
Even inside an office building with fluorescent lights?
Absolutely. And actually, it goes to the point that, I don't know whether you've read a book called The Nature of Economies by Jane Jacobs. It was written in 1999, 2000. And basically what she says is that the laws and principles of economics are the laws and principles of economies. And when we violate nature or the natural processes, then we also have an economy that doesn't work. And so I think I can see it all around me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even sitting in my car right now, human beings, wherever a human is in nature. Can't take them out of it.
So you're extending the concept of, you're considering that even interior urban environments are ecosystems as well?
Absolutely. Just like that cockroach came into your bathroom,
mm-hmm.
you know. Everything that man makes from nature. It's an environment, but it's an environment that cannot be outside of nature. And so that's sort of a perspective that I've taken on. And it really makes me appreciate all of nature differently and my life differently, because I really see how much more integrated it is. It's not just a matter of appreciation. It's a matter of our survival that we learn about nature.
I would hardly agree. Yeah, I think that reading Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma is a huge first step toward understanding you know, the interweaving of, you know, how we've taken nature and bent it to our needs,
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, disregarding some of its fundamental principles can get us in a huge amount of trouble.
Yeah, and Julie, I would say from reading the way you've written your book, that one of the things that you're trying to do by sharing these books is to help people or encourage people to return to an appreciation of what's out there without us touching, manipulating, changing, dominating everything.
Well, and yet, I recognize that you know, man's hand is everywhere on the land, and there's no habitat in Ohio that's gone untouched, or you know, that we haven't introduced some exotic vine to, or you know, we are everywhere. Our imprint is very heavy on this land, and you know, just being aware of that, being aware of our huge impact wherever we go and whatever we do.
All right, Mike, we appreciate you sharing your viewpoint.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, you
Thanks.
Too. We have a call now from Marcia. Hi, Marcia. You're on Open Line.
Hi. Good morning. I really appreciate all that you're saying, Julie, and you actually sound like my best friend. she loves this, just the minutia of life. We will go on walks, and I would just walk through the woods. You know, I was on the path, and that's where I was going. And she would stop me, and she would say, oh, my gosh, look at this butterfly, or look how the light is coming through the trees.
There you go.
Anyway, you know, I now appreciate it because of someone like her. So thank you for people like you.
Oh, you are so welcome. And, you know, it's so important to attach yourself to someone who maybe is a little more tuned in and who can open you to that. And, you know, I'm forever doing that with my kids. And now when I hear my daughter say, look at the light on those hay bales, it just fills my heart.
Absolutely.
It just fills my heart. Because, you know, it's, as a painter, it's really all about the light. It doesn't matter what you're painting, as long as you get the light true and right.
Yes. Absolutely.
And, you know, that's something that I'm still trying to do. I accomplish it maybe once in every 10 paintings, but when I do get it right, then that painting just sings and takes on a life of its own. And, you know, you realize as you look at Monet's paintings of haystacks, they aren't about haystacks.
No.
They're about the light playing on the haystacks.
That's right. That's exactly right. What I would like to do, Julie, is to get your book for my friend. Her birthday is coming up, and
there
it would be just absolutely a perfect gift for her.
Well, yeah, here's what you do. Go to juliezickafoos.com.
Will you spell that for me?
Sure. Z as in zebra.
Mm-hmm.
I-C-K.
Yes.
E-F as in Frank.
Yes.
O-O-S as in Sam.
Mm-hmm.
E.
Okay.
So
all
it's all one word, juliezickafoos.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, you'll see a banner ad for the book right there, and I will send her a personalized copy.
Oh, Julie, that's so wonderful.
Sure.
And again, thank you. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing and how you're opening up the world to many people.
Thank you, Marcia.
It's appreciated.
Okay.
Okay.
Marcia, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you, Charlene, and you're doing a terrific job.
Oh, thank you.
Bye.
Take care now.
Well, she's a little ray of sunshine.
Definitely. And I think you gave her some sunshine right back. You mentioned your daughter and how she is now seeing things differently. There are so many children around us now that do not have that opportunity and don't relate to nature at all. It's that ick factor.
Sure.
Pretty much towards everything.
Well,
how do you go about changing that when you have a child who has not been exposed to these things, but you're hoping to maybe change their attitude about
that? Right, right. Well, I just wrote a column on that in my column True Nature, which appears in Birdwatcher's Digest every month. And the thing that I've kind of come to in closely observing kids and their parents is that it's not actually a kid problem. It's actually a parent problem.
Huh.
And I think that the generations that came up, I'm 50, and the generations that have come up in, you know, baby boomer and the subsequent generations have each been a little farther removed from nature in my observation.
Yeah.
And one of the gauges that I use to this is when I take calls from people about wildlife rehab, and I try to get them to describe this animal or bird that they've got, and I'll say, how big is it? Oh, I don't know, it's pretty big. And I'll say, well, is it bigger than your palm? Oh, no, no, it's much smaller than my palm. You know, so I can't say, is it bigger than a sparrow or bigger than a robin, because they don't know what a sparrow or a robin, how big that is. Do you know
okay,
what I mean?
Okay, yes.
So I have
yeah.
to go back to such basics, and I'll say, okay, what color is it? Well, it's kind of grayish. All right, what color is its back? You know, so in other words, there's just no basis there. There's no basis. And I think that what might be going on is that I think that TV had a much bigger impact on us than we may be willing to admit. I think it kept us inside. I think it kept us on the couch. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I spent hours watching Andy Griffith and you know, Mike Douglas and you know, all those I Love Lucy reruns as a kid. So I did it too, but I still got out because my dad was raised on a farm, and he knew all this cool stuff that he would tell me. And so I think that we really need to look to ourselves before we say, oh, my kids just aren't interested in nature, and ask ourselves, well, am I getting out? Am I saying, guess what we're doing today? We're going to Ward State Nature Reserve, and we're going to take a hike in the waterfall.
And when they answer, but we wanted to play video games.
Right. Then you say, tough toenail.
Okay.
Guess what? We're going. And believe me, I have had to sling my son Liam, who's now 9, I've had to sling him over my shoulders like a sack of potatoes and walk out the meadow with him and say, you're going. You're going.
And that was that. And after a while, do they just kind of settle into it?
As soon as I set him down, he starts finding stuff. You know? And then I say, guess what, Liam? You're leading the way. You're the pathfinder. We're going to follow you. And that's all it takes to get him into it. That and a few chocolates, you know. So it's not like my kids are little junior nature rangers by any stretch. Mm-hmm. I have to figure out ways to make it enticing to them. And I do it. I take the time and I say, we're going on a hike. Or I take them with me checking my 26 bluebird boxes and let them hold the eggs and babies. That's really a potent thing. You know, when you've got a little squirming baby bluebird in your hand and it's your responsibility for those few moments.
Mm-hmm.
That's a powerful thing. So I think I'd rather point at parents who don't unplug the computer or the Wii, you know, who let that happen for hours on end.
So we have to be the ones that start it. And like you were saying, you can even start to build habitat just by what you plant in your yard. And then you can have your children help you tend that.
That's right. Get them involved. Say, these are Liam's peas. He planted them. Liam, go out and pick your peas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing.
Okay.
It's about a sense of ownership. It's a sense of feeling as if you did something.
There is a picture in Letters from Eden that I wanted to ask you about because it's really beautiful, and it looks like some birds I have actually seen in our backyard. It's on page 81.
Okay.
They're sort of tan-colored birds with a bright red slash across the back of their heads.
Oh, yes.
And they have speckled chests.
Mm-hmm. Those are northern flickers.
And what kind of a bird is that?
A flicker is a woodpecker. And it's a woodpecker that's in big trouble right now because we introduced European starlings in the late 1800s. And there was a crazy guy in New York City named Eugene Schieffelin who decided that he would introduce all of the birds that were mentioned in Shakespeare's writing. So he brought over English sparrows and he brought over European starlings. I'll have a starling, she'll be taught to say nothing but Mortimer. Do you remember that line?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he thought, well, this would be a wonderful thing. And the first pair nested under the eaves of the Smithsonian Institution in about 1860. Trying to think here. Can't quite remember the date. But anyway, there was great excitement because these exotic birds were taking a hold in the U.S., and we all know how many starlings we have now. Anyway, they compete for nest sites with northern flickers. And they'll let the flicker, which is equipped with a strong bill, excavate the hole, the cavity, and then they will take it over as soon as it's done.
Okay, so that was really a great experience to be able to see those birds in the yard. And unfortunately, Julie, we're running out of time. We could go on forever and ever, but we have certainly enjoyed having you on Open Line and being able to talk to you about your book, Letters from Eden.
Thank you so much, Charlene. It's been really fun for me, too.
Great. It's been certainly a pleasure for us. This is Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown, and we will continue in just a few minutes. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.